It is Friday, January the 13th. This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us. Coming up, hacked emails and Russian involvement, plus the U.S. president-elect.
A big debate, I think, that will continue probably for years is what impact did that have on the election? Did it, in fact, change the results of the election? I think that's probably an unknowable thing.
Possible case of mistaken identity involving Britain, Italy, and Eritrea. What's trending on social media these days? Plus, David Bowie's last band CD. Hello everyone, I'm Steve Norman. An independent watchdog at the U.S. Justice Department says he is launching a probe of the agency's handling of the investigation of Democratic Party presidential candidate Hillary Clinton's use of a private email server when she was Secretary of State, one of the most contentious issues of last year's election campaign that she lost to incoming President Donald Trump. Justice Department Inspector General Michael Horowitz said he would look at how the FBI, the Federal Bureau of Investigation, and its director James Comey conducted his year-long probe of Ms. Clinton. International Edition's Lori London talks about it with Jamil Jaffer. He is a national security expert and law professor at George Mason University.
The Department of Justice's Inspector General, who's sort of an outside entity, actually within the Justice Department, but that it, whose responsibility is to investigate things within their agency, sort of be an outside look at what the agency is doing. And so DOJ's Inspector General announced today that in response to congressional inquiries and other inquiries, that he's going to initiate an investigation of the way in which the FBI handled the Clinton investigation. And it sounds like they're going to include in that the decisions to send those letters to Congress and describe the status of the investigation, including the question of whether they should have made the disclosure about there are these new emails, the Anthony Weiner computer that they had. They discovered there were some Huma Abedin emails allegedly
just before the election.
And then they announce that, well, there's nothing in the emails. But by that point, there are those who say it had an impact on the election. And apparently, as the story goes, as we learned during the election time frame, apparently I believe it was the Deputy Attorney General, if I'm not mistaken, had made clear, or at least her staff had made clear to the FBI director that they didn't, that this was not the Justice Department's position, was the overall, the main justice, that is to say, because the FBI is within the Justice Department, oftentimes operates separately, but the main justice did not think that this was a right approach. In fact, that there were justice sort of general guidelines about how you operate in election time and that this was not the recommended approach.
So the Justice Department basically told the FBI this was not a good idea because it would potentially be interfering in the tone of the politics leading up to what was about to be an election. And the FBI did not follow that recommendation. And so now this basically is what I'm hearing is this Inspector General is going to look into this investigation, into the investigation and how it was handled.
That's right. The investigation is the investigation. Exactly right.
Well, and this whole email investigation and the leaking of so many of the Democratic National Committee's emails ahead of the election by WikiLeaks and the issue of Russia potentially interfering in the election, there is still a lot going on regarding an election that should be in our rearview mirrors now, particularly when it comes to Russia.
Yeah, well, look, I mean, I think that, there's been a lot of talk about Russian meddling in the elections, and it seems clear now that at least everybody agrees on one fact, which is that Russia was responsible for the hack of the DNC. The president said that yesterday. He acknowledged that. And so everyone agreed that Russia was involved in this and that this information got out there. Now, the big debate, I think, that will continue probably for years is what impact did that have on the election? Did it, in fact, change the results of the election? I think that's probably an unknowable thing. And so there's really not a lot we're going to learn more about that question. I think the other interesting question, though, that is going to be debated a lot is what were the motivations of the Russians? Now, we've seen in this last week, the intelligence community released an assessment that, in fact, what they had in mind was an effort to undermine Hillary Clinton. And in fact, the Intelligence Committee went further and said that their motive was to help Donald Trump. Now, I've got to be honest with you. I have, you know, long said since this whole issue of Russia election hacking started that I didn't think that it made a lot of sense for them to help Donald Trump for a variety of reasons. If that was, in fact, their intention, it didn't seem to make sense to me because of a couple of things. Number one, nation states generally want certainty, whether it's good certainty or bad certainty. They want to know what's going to happen so they can act accordingly. And Donald Trump is nothing if not uncertain for Russia and for a lot of things because he's an unknown quantity. Hillary Clinton, while Vladimir Putin might have thought she was bad for him or Russia might have thought she was, you know, bad for their country, they could largely predict what she might do. She wasn't an unknown quantity. And so it's surprising to me if, in fact, it turns out that the Intelligence Committee, and again, we may never know this, but if it turns out the Intelligence Committee was right and that this was an attempt to let Donald Trump, I think that was probably a mistake on their part. And in fact, it's funny because President-elect Trump actually said that yesterday at a news conference that was filled with all sorts of, you know, interesting things and you know, interesting back and forth. One thing he said, look, if Vladimir Putin thinks that he's elected somebody who's going to be friendly to him, you know, I don't think he should assume that. And by the way, he may have another thing coming if, in fact, things turn around. And so I think that's very telling because I think that's actually very, I think it's probably a pretty accurate statement from the president-elect about himself, which is that, you know, he may very well be a very stiff opponent of Russia if, in fact, it comes down to the question of what he thinks is in the national interest and he doesn't think the Russians are there.
Jamil Jaffer is a national security expert, also a law professor at George Mason University. He was speaking with my colleague, Lori London. This is VOA.
On Friday, January 20th, the 45th President of the United States, Donald J. Trump, will be sworn into office. VOA will be there and will broadcast the presidential inauguration live from 1600 UTC to 1800 UTC to audiences around the world. Tune in as we begin the next chapter in American history, right here on VOA.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program, Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. Italy reopened its embassy in Libyan capital, Tripoli, this week, the first Western country to do so since most others left in 2015 during a worsening conflict between rival factions there. All that chaos allowed Libya to become the major gateway for migrants to Italy, but as Henry Ridgewell tells us, analysts say Italy's move is almost aimed at countering increased Russian influence in Libya's fragile politics.
Rome's foreign minister described the embassy reopening as a great gesture of friendship to the Libyan people and also promised more controls on migration from Libyan shores. Analyst Riccardo Fabiani of the Eurasia Group says the move is partly driven by domestic politics.
Everybody knows that migration will be the key topic during the next electoral campaign. So the government is basically trying to intervene, and what it would like to do is to help basically the Libyan security sector, Libyan militias, to stop the migrants before they reach the coast.
It is also a show of support for Libya's Tripoli-based National Unity Government, which is suffering internal divisions as it struggles to establish legitimacy. The Arab League's envoy to Libya, Saladin al-Jamali, warned this week the country is at breaking point. Al-Jamali told an Arab League meeting in Cairo that the security situation in Libya remains unstable and could explode at any moment if the political process fails. A rival administration rules the east of Libya, overseen by self-styled strongman General Khalifa Haftar, head of the Libyan National Army. Last November, Haftar met Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov in Moscow to ask for military help. This week, after the Russian aircraft carrier Admiral Kuznetsov docked in the eastern Libyan city of Tobruk, General Haftar was invited on board to meet senior military chiefs. Again, analyst Riccardo Fabiani.
General Haftar is the perfect, I would say, interlocutor for the Russians, because he is, let's say, very much keen to reestablish the old order in Libya. And it's very similar to the situation that the Russians have faced in Syria, supporting somebody who wants to reestablish order, reestablish control over Libya.
Moscow's backing for Haftar sets up another arena of potential rivalry between Russia and the West.
It's clear that their end goal is to support Haftar, to make sure that he can win and rule Libya, and to increase their influence in the region. But it's very clear that they are waiting for Trump to be the next president in the US and to understand what are the new rules of the game in Libya.
If those rules change, analysts say the involvement of foreign powers would likely further destabilize Libya's precarious situation. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
Eritrea's government says a man being held in an Italian jail on suspicion of being a people smuggler is a victim of mistaken identity. In June last year, Italian and British officials say they captured Medhani Yedego Mir, a suspected key player in the smuggling of thousands of migrants and refugees from North Africa to Europe. However, a document and photo sent by the Eritrean government indicate the man being held in Italy is not Mir. The person is identified as Medhani Tesfar Mariam Berhi, an Eritrean refugee who appears to have no connection to the smuggling operation. Reporter Josephine McKenna is following this story, and she speaks now from Rome with VOA's Kim Lewis, and talks about if this case is of mistaken identity, it would be a major embarrassment, she says, to the Italian and British authorities.
This is the strongest evidence yet that the authorities have arrested the wrong man. Now, the Eritrean government has said that the man being held in an Italian jail on suspicion of people smuggling is a victim of mistaken identity, and a document presented in court in Palermo seems to support that claim. So this case involved Italian and British officials last year. They claimed to have captured Medhani Yedego Mered. He was considered to be a key player in the smuggling of thousands of migrants and refugees from North Africa to Europe. After being extradited from Sudan to Italy, the suspect is facing two prosecutions, one in Sicily and one in Rome. But now with these doubts about his identity, that is going to really cast doubt on the future of this particular case. On Tuesday, the prosecution's case was further weakened by a document sent by the Eritrean Department of Immigration to the suspect's lawyer, Michele Kalantropo, saying that the man in custody is believed to be, in fact, Medhani Tesfarmiaram Berhe, a different man, an Eritrean refugee with no connection to the people smuggling business.
So then what would be the next step?
The prosecutors in Rome have also seemed to have broken ranks with their Sicilian colleagues and suggested that this may be indeed the wrong man, and have even submitted a document saying that there are good grounds to indicate that the man in custody is not the man that they are looking for. It looks like it's up to the court to really assess the latest information, the latest evidence, and decide whether there will indeed be a case to answer here. And what's interesting is the prosecutors in Sicily did not oppose the presentation of this official document from the Eritrean government. And so that would indicate some sort of support from them that perhaps this case should not continue. We're just waiting for further information from the courts in Sicily to see what will come out of this. But it's certainly terribly embarrassing if this is the case for both Italian and British officials who claim to have captured a major people smuggler.
What information do you have on the other person?
Well, the other man, believed to be one of the world's most wanted people smugglers, even posted on his Facebook page in November that he was at large and suggested that an innocent man had been seized and extradited by mistake. Now, they were private messages sent from his Facebook account publicized in the British media. And he was saying that Mered was really the victim of mistaken identity. It's not clear exactly where real people smuggler is at the moment, but apparently it was written in Tigrinya, one of the widely spoken languages in Eritrea, and admitted that a mistake had been made. So that's also very interesting that he himself has said the wrong man is in custody.
That is reporter Josephine McKenna in Rome, and she was speaking with Kim Lewis, who is host of the VOA program Africa News Tonight. Taiwan's President Tsai Ing-wen stopped over in Houston, Texas, on her way to Central America not long ago, and now we're going to look at the significance of that meeting and how it might play out on the global stage. We get more now from VOA's Steve Miller.
Following the 2016 presidential election, President-elect Donald Trump took a call from Taiwanese President Tsai Ing-wen and questioned whether the United States should continue following the policy laid out in 1979, recognizing the communist-led People's Republic of China as the sole government of China, or One China. This week, when Tsai was traveling to Central America, she had a brief stopover in Houston, Texas. There, she met with Senator Ted Cruz and Texas Governor Greg Abbott. John Minnick, senior East Asia analyst with intelligence firm Stratfor, says on Skype that the significance isn't in the meeting itself, but
there is a significance that lays in the broader context of the visit, and it takes place against a backdrop of real flux in cross-strait relations and U.S.-Taiwan relations. I mean, this is a moment of incredible uncertainty as to what's going to happen.
Minnick says that Tsai is essentially caught in the middle as the United States and China are rethinking their relationships. However, speaking via Skype, Harry Kazianis, the director of defense studies at the Center for the National Interest, called the meeting
extremely significant because they're trying to reach out beyond the Trump camp and to reach out to other mainstream Republicans to try and build these connections and to build these linkages.
And while in the here and now, attention is focused on the Tsai-Cruz-Abbott meeting in Texas, Minnick points out that last year, Tsai met Senator Marco Rubio in Florida, so this type of meeting isn't the first of its kind. Kazianis also emphasized its low-key nature and how Taiwan doesn't necessarily want to upset the status quo. But as Minnick points out,
on the most fundamental level, Taiwan's sovereignty is an issue of other countries. And with that in mind, Taiwan's in a very precarious situation right now because China has been very adamant, very steadfast in working to further isolate Taiwan diplomatically.
So why take a meeting with Tsai? Harry Kazianis.
I think Senator Cruz is very clear that he's very interested in Asia policy. He's very interested also in trying to build ties with Taiwan for his state.
Noting that there's a significant trade relationship between the U.S. and Taiwan.
So we're talking about billions and billions of dollars of bilateral trade. And I think that's very important for the individual states to try and work with Taiwan. And for Taiwan, it's very important. It's difficult for them to increase the bilateral relationship as much as they want with the United States. But the individual states can do that very reasonably and very effectively.
China has established the adherence of the One China policy as the basis for continued relations with Beijing. And because it has a robust military and is the second largest world economy with global ties, Kazianis suggests
no country is going to change the One China policy. However, there's a lot of room for maneuver just below that threshold.
If a country does decide to break with that, Minnick says China would respond
through diplomatic isolation, military intimidation of Taiwan to compel Taiwan to back off, but also do what it can through economic coercion to affect that country.
Steve Miller, VOA News, Washington.
And many thanks to you, Steve. We're going to shift gears now and find out what's trending on social media. And here to tell us all about it, G. Abby Lee. Hey, G, what's happening?
Hi, Steve. I'm sure you could have guessed that people are talking about the big surprise Vice President Joe Biden got Thursday afternoon. At his White House farewell, President Barack Obama surprised him with Presidential Medal of Freedom, and Mr. Biden was moved to tears. Now, for those of our listeners outside of the U.S., it's the highest civilian award. People are tweeting about the very close bond between Mr. Obama and Mr. Biden, and the organic reaction the vice president had to the surprise. He said he had no inkling.
You know, I caught that event on Facebook. I was really touched by that part where we hear about how President Obama was there for Vice President Biden after his son's death. A very, very moving part of that presentation on Thursday. Why don't we move on to see what else is out there trending?
Another story from D.C. American billionaire Jeff Bezos, who is the founder of Amazon and the owner of Washington Post, purchased a massive former museum to turn it into a single-family home. The reason? To avoid hotel bills. But many people are saying $23 million is a lot for a pied-à-terre.
That's got to be opening up for a lot of jokes.
Oh, absolutely. One person wrote, "If Bezos eats the nuts from the minibar, this is a sound investment," poking fun at the high price you pay for hotel minibars. The area he's purchasing a home from is a swanky neighborhood called Calorama, next to homes of other famous people. One person tweeted, "Jeff Bezos, the Obamas, Ivanka Trump, and Jared Kushner. Now that's a block party." Back to you.
Yeah, no doubt. I can't wait to see that block party. That's going to happen soon, I doubt it. Hey, listen, many thanks, G International Editions, G Abby Lee here. By the way, you can follow G on Twitter at G Abby Lee. I'm there as well at VOA Norman, and our program, International Edition, can be found on Twitter at VOA_IE. This is VOA.
This is BizBeat.
The sun sets over Tel Aviv, where thousands of entrepreneurs create high-tech startup companies in a land with few natural resources.
No mining, no oil, no stuff like that. The only resource, the only natural resource that we have is the most powerful one, the human brain.
Moshe Hogeg is the co-founder of Siren Labs, claiming to make the world's most secure phone, but they've raked in $70 million in venture capital. Another startup, Aerobotics, has secured millions of dollars also, designing drones requiring no human involvement. Worldwide, Tel Aviv is considered a top startup destination, and Eyal Gura, an investor and founder of Zebra Medical Vision, says Israel has three times more venture money per capita than the United States.
So it's easier to raise money here, actually.
And Marty Kushner develops glasses projecting 3D images and holograms, and he says,
"We are not afraid of failures."
For VOA's BizBeat, I'm Philip Alexio.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us today. You know, it's been more than a year now since David Bowie died, which was just after the famed British musician had released his album Black Star. Donnie McCaslin is the leader of the jazz band that backed Bowie on Black Star, and as David Byrd tells us, the saxophonist used his music to help him process his grief over Bowie's death.
I can't answer why. Just go with me. I'ma take you home. Take your passport and shoes.
David Bowie died of liver cancer just 2 days after his 69th birthday and the release of his last CD, Black Star. Bowie recorded the album with a jazz band that included saxophonist Donnie McCaslin. McCaslin and the other members of Bowie's last band have released their own CD, Beyond Now. The disc includes the band's cover of some Bowie tunes, and McCaslin says the music has helped him deal with his grief.
For me, one of the things is the way I'm able to channel some of my feelings is through music, and a couple of weeks after he passed away, we started this run at the Village Vanguard here in New York City, and as part of the way we paid tribute to him that week was by playing one of his songs, and that really it was really helpful. It was a really raw and emotional time, and having that as a vehicle of expression was really great.
Bowie recruited McCaslin along with bassist Tim LaFave, piano player Jason Lindner, and drummer Mark Juliana for Black Star. McCaslin says for a long time he couldn't listen to the album, but eventually the music and Bowie's vision drew him back to it.
It's still emotional, but there's a period where I couldn't listen to it, and then I've had periods where I have been able to listen to it and just sort of take it all in, and the music. And I think that's also helped the process. And then making Beyond Now, which was influenced so much by what I experienced with David, and having the opportunity to make that record and do a couple of his tunes and feel his influence on the songs that I wrote, was great. And trying to sort of capture the emotional gravitas that he went for as an artist.
The band included Bowie's A Small Plot of Land and Warszawa on the CD. McCaslin says that working with the legendary rocker and artist inspired him to be fearless in his own music and to pursue his vision, regardless of whether it fit into genres or other people's tastes.
And I think that's the best way I could pay tribute to him, is to play, you know, music that is just reaching, you know, reaching for something new, reaching for something outside of the box. He was an artist that really could think outside the box and develop that and surround himself with people who could realize that vision with him.
Donnie McCaslin is currently on tour. Beyond Now is available online and in stores. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
Many thanks to you, David. Always pleased to have you on the program. And listen, thanks to you for tuning in today to the Voice of America, an international edition. Our latest world news is straight ahead. Hope you'll stay tuned. And for our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, John Ellison, I'm Steve Norman. We're all in Washington and wishing you a happy Friday.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In Iraq and Syria, U.S.-led coalition forces are making progress in the fight against ISIL, including in two crucial areas, killing its leaders and taking back territory. The U.S. Defense Department announced this month that a Syria-based Islamic State leader, Mahmoud al-Isawi, died in a coalition airstrike in Raqqa on December 31st. Al-Isawi was a long-standing ISIL member who controlled the flow of instructions and finances between ISIL-held areas and ISIL leaders, and provided support to propaganda and intelligence outlets. Al-Isawi was also known to have facilitated trans-regional travel with other ISIL external operations coordinators and had a close relationship with Abd al-Basit al-Iraqi, the emir of ISIL's Middle East attack network, who was killed in a coalition airstrike on November 2, 2016. Al-Isawi's death brought the number of significant ISIL leaders killed last year to 16. These losses, as the Defense Department said, have degraded ISIL's transregional attack and facilitation network and are forcing ISIL fighters to increase their focus on internal security. In a press briefing from Baghdad, U.S. Air Force Colonel John Dorian, spokesman for Operation Inherent Resolve, also noted the progress being made in liberating territory from the terrorists. In Syria, he said, the Syrian Democratic Forces are continuing their advance to isolate Raqqa.
Since this current phase began on December 9th, the SDF have liberated more than 500 square miles of Syrian land, home to tens of thousands of people who have been brutalized by ISIL's rule.
In Iraq, Colonel Dorian noted, Iraqi security forces, with the help of coalition airstrikes and advisors, are making progress in their operation to liberate Mosul.
The city is completely surrounded, and the enemy doesn't have the ability to resupply or reinforce their fighters.
Colonel Dorian said, as difficult and dangerous as the fight for Mosul is and will be, time is not on the enemy's side. It's on the side of the Iraqi security forces, and they are going to retake Mosul. ISIL is a brutal and determined enemy, but the U.S.-led coalition and the local fighters it supports will keep intensifying the pressure until Syria and Iraq are free from ISIL's gruesome grip.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.